From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Retired four-star Marine Corps General John Kelly was sworn in today as the new White House Chief of Staff, replacing Reince Priebus, who left after that vulgar, expletive-laden attack in The New Yorker from new communications director Anthony Scaramucci. Kelly had previously been Trump's Secretary of Homeland Security, and today the president praised his immigration enforcement, saying it was record-shattering, and pointing out with a very controversial situation there's been very little controversy. That's, of course, something the White House could use. But over the weekend, the president created more, telling Republican lawmakers to get back to work on health care, even though Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said they were moving on after Friday's failed vote. The president tweeted, "If a new health care bill is not approved quickly, bailouts for insurance companies and bailouts for members of Congress will end very soon." Well, let's get a reminder of what he means and fill in the calendar for the rest of the week with NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent Ron Elving. Hi, Ron.
Hello, Robin.
And we know that the subsidies to insurance companies are to help them cover the very poor, but lawmakers and their staffs were moved onto the exchanges as part of the new law in 2010. But individually, they make too much for those subsidies. So explain how they're subsidized.
We have to start by saying health insurance in some form has long been part of the benefits package for members of Congress and their staffs. And at one time, when Obamacare was first being passed, they were going to be exempt from it and keep their longstanding insurance package. But it looked bad, and some of the members knew it looked bad, and there was a bill introduced and changes were made. And as a result of that, the members and their staffs had to go on to Obamacare rather than getting the previous benefits package. And in order to keep that from being a huge hit, something that would really change their terms of employment, they were eligible for some of these other payments to be helped with them. And so initially they weren't going to be part of it, and then they were. And they came up with this particular arrangement to even things out.
Well, and we understand that part of this was that these congressional offices were allowed to be called small businesses. And so they got covered that way. But now President Trump is saying, I'm going to take it away. Can he do that? Can the president take all the subsidies that keep the insurers in the game away?
The president can suddenly say, we're not going to issue those payments, and the next set is due this week. They have been making them up until now, so they would have to say that something had materially changed. And, of course, it's been suggested by many people who want to dial up the heat on the insurance companies. But at the same time, the insurance companies have some rights here under the law, and the law has not been changed because nothing has been passed by Congress to change the law. So without that, the insurance companies have some standing here to sue, and they've already been filing suit about a number of other things that the administration has done that seem to them, at least to the insurance companies, to be breaking the government's commitments to them. And by the way, those 19 counties in Ohio that were without an insurance carrier, that has been that gap has been plugged, and that announcement has just come today. So those counties are no longer unserved by any insurance coverage under Obamacare.
Well, but who knows what's going to happen if these subsidies are taken away? And you point to something called the Problem Solvers Caucus in the House. This is a group of centrists trying to stabilize the ACA markets. Tell us more.
As for policy, stabilizing those markets is the crucial point in the president, in the immediate present and the immediate future. And these people in the Problem Solvers Caucus, as they call themselves, they have their eye on the ball. They know what needs to be done to keep worse things from happening than what have happened already. And the choice of their name is maybe a little bit self-serving, but their message is definitely a good one. Let's get back to solving the problem. As for the politics, you know, it's overdue in a lot of ways to get more bipartisanship in the Senate, in the House as well. The Democratic strategy of total resistance has been effective for them, but ultimately it's not helpful. And for the Republicans, they've been driven up to now in the House by the House Freedom Caucus, which is even smaller than the group that's calling themselves the Problem Solvers, fewer than 40 members. But the numbers ultimately are the point. 40 people in either direction is less than 1 in 10. And in the House, you need 218 to prevail. So they need a lot of leverage from what they've been able to go to so far.
Well, and the House is on a 5-week break, and the Senate's expected to go in 2 weeks. Look, General Kelly, new chief of staff, they're cheering in the Alston-Brighton section of Boston. His dad, a longtime mailman there, he was a hero at Veterans Halls. The White House, more Wall Street. What's your sense of how that's going to work?
They need someone who can assert the authority that Reince-Priebus was denied. He was not able to assert the authority because he wasn't given it by the president. The president has chosen a 45-year veteran of the Marine Corps. He knows about discipline. He knows about consolidating power and authority. And, you know, he's had success at the Department of Homeland Security, largely around the border issues. What he needs now is to set some boundaries for the people in the White House. Who can walk into the White House unannounced? Who just has walk-in privileges, and he also needs to impose some of that discipline on the man who works in the Oval Office.
Let's see what happens. NPR Senior Washington Editor and Correspondent Ron Elving, thanks as always.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, with their health care overhaul on hold once again, Republican leaders in Congress are looking ahead to the next big item on their wish list, tax reform. President Trump is calling for sweeping changes to the country's tax code, saying it's necessary to get the economy to 3% annual growth in GDP. But so far, Republican leaders haven't given much detail on how they would change the tax system, other than to say they want to lower taxes on nearly everybody. Joining us now is Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic. Hi, Derek.
Hey, Jeremy.
And everybody in Washington seems to agree that tax reform is necessary, but they disagree on how it should be done. What do we know about what the Republican plan, if there is one, is so far?
What we seem to know is what you just said, that Republicans seem to want to cut tax rates for individuals, for businesses, for corporations. But, Jeremy, tax reform is a weird duck because typically as you approach a vote on a landmark piece of legislation, you learn more about the bill. What makes the case of tax reform so unusual is that we're actually learning less about the bill as time goes on. For example, a simple question, will taxes on the rich go up or down? Well, in a one-page summary of the White House tax plan from several months ago, the answer was very clearly down. But now it's been reported that Steve Bannon, a top advisor, actually wants taxes on multimillionaires to go up. So up or down, we don't know. Another feature that was supposed to be in the tax reform plan was something called border adjustment, which we might talk a little bit about later. It's basically a sales tax that encourages exports. But that's not important anymore because even though this was one of the big ideas in tax reform, it's now dead. So we are literally learning less about this plan as we move toward its theoretical vote.
On the issue of the border adjustment tax, that was one of the few Republican proposals that would actually raise revenue. Have Republicans said how they're going to ensure that whatever they do with taxes doesn't add more to the deficit?
It's tough because on the one hand, tax reform is typically deficit neutral. Famous 1986 tax reform under Ronald Reagan was more or less deficit neutral. It didn't raise the deficit. That means if you cut taxes on individuals, you have to raise taxes somewhere else. Sometimes this is called cutting the rates and broadening the base. That means taking away some tax deductions, like maybe the mortgage interest deduction or the state and local tax deduction. But we just aren't anywhere close enough to be able to say that that's what Republicans are going to be able to do. Tax reform is incredibly hard. There's a reason that it hasn't happened in 31 years, and it took a very functional Ronald Reagan administration 1.5 to 2 years just to get this one vote through. It's going to take this administration and this Congress certainly a long time.
Well, one of the things that I am sure we're going to hear as this debate gets going is that we don't have to offset these tax cuts because they'll pay for themselves. The economy will grow faster and then it's no big deal. Is there evidence that that's true or not?
This is a very thorny question, but the short answer is we don't have enough evidence to be sure that a tax cut will promote growth. There was several years ago I wrote an analysis of 60 years of tax and growth data looking at tax cuts from Kennedy and Reagan and Clinton. And it found that changing tax rates, and here I quote, have had little association with saving, investment, or productivity growth. Now, it doesn't mean that tax cuts aren't going to move the needle at all. Certainly, it'll make people feel a bit richer. They'll be able to keep more of their earnings. But I think it's important to note that tax cuts are not Miracle-Gro. The economic history of the U.S. does not suggest that by cutting taxes, you automatically wave a magic wand over the economy and it sprouts like magic.
All right, Derek, there's something else going on that I need to ask you about. Besides the tax reform issue, Congress has to raise the debt ceiling. When they come back from their August recess, they're going to have just 12 working days to raise the federal borrowing limit or risk the federal government running out of money to pay its bills. Is there going to be a fight this year?
There may be a fight. The president's budget director has said that he's willing to hold the debt ceiling hostage until Republicans repeal Obamacare. But now we hear that the administration is moving on to tax reform. So the ransomers are a little bit confused. Is the next thing up Obamacare, or is the next thing up tax reform, or is the next thing up the debt ceiling? I think the big picture here, the story behind the story, is that this administration is extremely convoluted when it comes to policy. The president doesn't preference policy. His deputies aren't putting a lot of pressure on specific policy measures. And as a result, there isn't a lot of direction coming from the White House. So certainly, one hopes that the debt ceiling is raised. It could be catastrophic if it is not. Right. But it's not clear what item is next up on the agenda.
That's Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic. Derek, thanks as always.
Thank you.
The mayor of Nashville announced over the weekend that her 22-year-old son died of a drug overdose. It's not clear what he overdosed on, but the majority of drug overdose deaths involve an opioid. And many of those opioids are coming into the U.S. from other countries, primarily Mexico and China. Joining us now is Ambassador Bill Brownfield, who's the Assistant Secretary in the State Department's Bureau of International Narcotics and Law Enforcement. Ambassador Brownfield, welcome.
Thank you very much, Jeremy. A pleasure to be here.
Well, and when you look at the opioid crisis overall in this country, how many of those drugs are coming in from outside of the United States?
Listen, when I talk about the current crisis, I say it's not just opioids. It's opioids, it's heroin, and it's fentanyl. Now, most of the opioids that are consumed here in the United States are, in fact, domestically produced and then diverted into the black market. But nearly 100% of the heroin that is consumed here comes from outside of the United States. The overwhelming majority, like 95% of that, from Mexico. And the fentanyl, which is taking what is already a crisis and turning it into a mega crisis, overwhelmingly comes from outside the United States as well. In this case, largely from China.
From China. And last year, the U.S. and China agreed to work together to stop fentanyl and other similar drugs from coming into the U.S. from China. Has that worked?
Jeremy, I'm going to give you a pretty good news story here, not because I'm Pollyanna and always looking for the positives of a story, but rather because we have a fairly good story to tell. We started a serious dialogue with China about 3 years ago on the matter of fentanyl and other synthetic drugs that are coming into the United States. Since that time, China has moved to control, by which I mean to place law enforcement restrictions on 136 synthetic products, including fentanyl and all of the analogs, kind of the fentanyl-based synthetics that are produced lawfully in China over the last year and a half. They have worked with us in the international organizations, the International Narcotics Control Board, the Commission on Narcotic Drugs, to place UN controls on precursors for fentanyl. And I've got to tell you, I do not claim that all parts of the bilateral relationship between the U.S. and China are working well. But on drugs, I give them credit. We're cooperating quite well.
But we're still seeing fentanyl pop up in much bigger numbers around the U.S.
We most assuredly are. I believe what is happening today is that there is still some legitimate and legal fentanyl produced in China that goes into legal or licit markets, and a great deal of fentanyl is exported from China to Mexico. In Mexico, it is then diverted into the criminal trafficking stream, if you will, where largely heroin trafficking organizations introduce fentanyl into their heroin product, which is then trafficked into the United States. And the danger, as you well know, and I'm sure I don't have to explain to you, the danger of fentanyl, a product that is perhaps 10 to 50 times as potent as morphine or heroin. The danger, of course, is that if the user thinks he's just using a heroin product and is unaware that it has been made infinitely more potent by the introduction of fentanyl, the risk of overdose and the risk of death is much, much higher.
What about the even more dangerous carfentanyl?
Yep, which is sometimes described as fentanyl on steroids. If fentanyl is 10 to 50 times stronger than morphine, carfentanil is 10 to 50 times stronger than fentanyl. And to indicate just how strong it is usually used as an elephant or large game tranquilizer.
Right. And is it coming from China or Mexico or both?
Much of it is being produced in China. China has worked with us, first in terms of controlling their own carfentanil, to ensure that anything that leaves Chinese shores legally is under customs and economic ministry controls. Second, they have joined us in asking the World Health Organization to schedule carfentanil, which is to say to certify it as a dangerous product, which therefore should be on the United Nations global list of controlled substances and controlled products. We are today just beginning to see carfentanil enter into the criminal drug trafficking networks, but it is so incredibly dangerous, where nothing more than a tiny grain of the stuff can kill a human being, that we do want to get on top of this as quickly as we possibly can.
We did some reporting from Mexico earlier this year, and one of the things that we heard was, you know, you're looking at the source of some of these drugs, but actually the demand is coming from the United States. So my question to you is, even if you were able to sign agreements and stop these drugs from coming in, can you really stop the drugs from coming in if the demand exists in the U.S.?
Now, Jeremy, you put your finger on the age-old problem and the discussion that we have had here in the U.S. for 50 years or more. If there is no demand, there is no production. Of course, by the same token, if there is no production, then eventually demand will die out. At the end of the day, my argument is as follows. We have, in fact, a serious growing problem with drug abuse on some specific products today in the United States of America. 95% of the heroin consumed in the United States comes from Mexico, and yet we are making good progress with the government of Mexico under the Merida Initiative to address this issue. Colombia today produces 250% of the cocaine that it was producing as recently as 2013. Hmm. And yet we are working cooperatively with the Colombian government under Plan Colombia. More than 80% of the South American product comes to the United States through the Mexico and Central America corridor that we are addressing through the Central America Regional Security Initiative. Most of the synthetics and certainly most of the fentanyl and carfentanil comes to China. We are working much more closely with them now than we ever have before. We've got a problem. We have a crisis, and the news is pretty grim. But my message for you, Jeremy, and I guess for those who are listening, is that our international architecture for cooperation and engagement is much stronger today than it was as recently as just 10 years ago.
How many people are involved in getting some fentanyl from China to, let's say, Cleveland, Ohio?
This is what most frightens me, Jeremy, about fentanyl. It is actually a much easier process and a much easier product to insert into the supply chain than is cocaine or heroin. The laboratory process is much simpler. The transportation is in much smaller packages, and you can do in an envelope what might take you a truck with a larger product. That is what we have to address from a law enforcement perspective, both here at home also bilaterally with certain key countries, our neighbors, Mexico and Canada, major players like China. But finally, in the entire international context, working within the UN system to ensure that there is a single standard applied throughout the world that puts legal controls on the production, export, and import of fentanyl.
Let me ask you this question, and I don't mean for it to sound political, but I would like to ask you, would a wall along the border help in the drug war?
Oh, you rascal. I'm not going to take on that issue directly. What I will tell you is a matter of simple common sense. A wall, like almost any other element along a border, is a tactical opportunity. No specific technological, or for that matter, construction device is going to provide an absolute and complete protection. Whether it's radars or movement detectors, whether it's a fence or a wall, for that matter, whether it is lining up a border guard every 10 yards, everything is subject to being assessed and worked around by professional trafficking organizations. But by the same token, it is a tactical opportunity. So my own guess is that in the years to come, we will talk about how all of the elements, the technological elements, the intelligence collection elements, the personnel and transportation elements that we can apply both at the border and downstream, deeper into countries from which the product or the people are moving, will all be part of an integrated law enforcement and border control exercise.
That's Ambassador Bill Brownfield, who is the Assistant Secretary in the State Department's Bureau of International Narcotics and Law Enforcement. Ambassador, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Jeremy. It's been a pleasure.
And we'll link you to some of our other conversations about the opioid crisis at hereandnow.org. Training camp is underway for NFL teams across the country, and that means coaches are devising ways to motivate their players for the coming season. Maybe you've got a big project deadline or quarterly review coming up at work, and you could also use a pep talk. But what makes a good pep talk? That's something Harvard Business Review has been looking at, and their senior editor, Kurt Nickisch, joins us now to talk about it. Hi, Kurt.
Hey, Jeremy.
And researchers have looked at this question. How exactly did they determine what makes a good pep talk?
They actually studied coaches and saw what they said to their teams. They've also looked at CEOs giving talks at all-hands meetings to see how companies perform, whether or not they do better. And I think a lot of us think that pep talks are all about adrenaline, like, you know, right, go make some sales, go take out that team. But what they found is that it's much more complicated than that.
Well, and that it involves three things. How to do the task at hand, show concern for people doing that task, and then explain why the task is important. So let's break that down, starting with uncertainty-reducing language. What's that?
Yeah, so this is basically giving instructions, giving step-by-step information, giving people detailed information about how they're going to be evaluated. Because when you're put in a high-pressure situation where you're trying to, you know, have that end-of-quarter sales meeting or you're trying to do that big presentation, you know, there's a lot wrapped up in that. And so giving people just information about here's how it's going to go, just practical information, actually puts them in a comfort zone where they're able to perform better.
And the other two parts of the formula are meaning-making language and empathetic language. What are some examples of that?
Yeah, so empathy is just like, how are you doing? How are you feeling about this? And meaning-making is telling people why it's important for the company or for the goals of the team or bringing it back to something that's important to those people.
Now, there's another approach that people may have seen in the movies. And let's play a clip here of the famous speech from the 1992 film Glengarry Glen Ross. Alec Baldwin plays a real estate salesman trying to motivate others in the office to close more deals. Always be closing. Let's listen.
You can't play in the man's game. You can't close them. Then go home and tell your wife your troubles. Because only one thing counts in this life. Get them to sign on the line which is dotted.
Wow, his voice sounds different now than it did then. It's that approach. What about that approach? It's degrading, insulting, mean, you could say. What does research say about it?
Yeah, it doesn't really fit that empathetic language right. that we were talking about. I don't know that anybody studied this. Researchers have looked at things like trash talk and whether it really works. I think you might find that people will feel some pressure and go out and make some sales. But long term, is this a way to like keep growing and have a, you know, have a happy workforce? I kind of doubt it.
Are companies right now finding it more difficult to motivate people? Is that why we're looking at this issue?
No, I think that it's just the fact that, you know, we all have like this work now where there are just a couple of moments throughout the year where something can be really important and can kind of make or break your year. It's different from working in the factory and doing the same thing every day. We all have this kind of episodic work where we have to perform at our best at key points. And so I think that's why companies are looking more closely at how like the best athletes, the best professionals manage these situations well.
We'll link people to more about a good pep talk at hereandnow.org. Kurt Nikisch, senior editor at Harvard Business Review. Thanks so much.
You got it.
A recent headline in the AP caught our eye. Black women picking up firearms for self-defense. And in the photos, a robed minister clutching a Bible and her handgun, an airline attendant taking aim with her Glock. Now, in places where they track the race of gun purchasers, black women are outpacing whites. Then there's the National African American Gun Association, founded in 2012 by Philip Smith, who thought he'd get a few members. He now has 20,000 with 30 chapters across the country. Marshall Tigner is Assistant Director of Training for the National African American Gun Association. She's a firearms instructor. She travels the country teaching women gun safety. Of her 700 students, 97% are African American, as she is. Her company is Trigger Happy Firearm Instruction. And Marshall joins us from Georgia Public Radio in Savannah. Marshall, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm okay, but you know, for some people, there's a flinch there. Trigger Happy Firearm Instruction. Talk a little bit about your tone there. What are you trying to do?
So it's not literally about firearms. It's more so a life mantra. You know, instead of waiting and hesitating on deciding what you wanted to do with your life, just pull the trigger, you know, jump out there and see what happens.
And in your case, guns might not have been on the horizon, but then you went to the National Guard. Did you have some sort of a transformation on guns?
I did. Initially, when I was growing up, my parents kept us away from firearms. We didn't have them in the home. And the things that I saw on TV led me to believe that only the police officers have firearms and criminals. And when I joined the military, my thought process changed. They're not just for criminals to have. They're for law enforcement and the general public to carry them if they so choose for self-defense purposes.
Well, you know, when we were at the Democratic Convention in Philadelphia, we met up with Maj Touré. He has founded a group called Black Guns Matter. And at first, I had the same reaction some people may be having hearing from you, that it seemed counterintuitive, that blacks are disproportionately victims of gun violence. White adults are more likely than blacks or Hispanics to own guns, but black adults are more likely to know someone who's been shot.
Right.
So the thinking is, why would you want to have more guns around, since more guns might lead to more of that gun violence?
I believe that we have to change the stereotypes that are associated with black people and firearms. Every story you see with a black person and a firearm is a negative story. It's about someone, you know, getting shot or someone robbing someone. So I wanted to change that narrative and make it normal. We can exercise our Second Amendment rights just like everyone else can, and it's not just a bad thing or making you a criminal. And I think education is key to changing that narrative.
Well, Maj Touré, again, a young man who founded Black Guns Matter, his point was, why are we being left out of this equation? We're the only ones then who are defenseless.
And I completely agree with that. The reason why the Second Amendment right is there is to protect and defend our First Amendment right of free speech. So in the black community, we can't speak freely if we cannot defend our right to speak freely.
Again, back to Philip Smith, who founded the African American Gun Association. He thinks there's something particular to this time that might be why more African Americans are arming themselves. Do you agree?
I believe that it's being more popularized, the stories on the internet and the news about, you know, African Americans being shot by law enforcement officers. And it's extremely unfortunate. And I think that's bringing up the conversation more. And African Americans are not thinking of firearms necessarily as a bad thing as they used to. They're thinking of it more as self-defense. And I think it's a good thing.
Well, how would a gun help in that situation? We saw what happened to Philando Castile. He was licensed to carry. He told the officer who stopped him he had a gun. But after that, any hand movement he made, the officer thought he was reaching for the gun. How does a gun help there?
I think it's the stereotypes that are associated with Black people with guns that make it such a frightful thing for law enforcement, because it's not normal to them. So when they see Black people with firearms, they're automatically thinking, okay, that person is a bad guy. And if we normalize it and have everyday African-American citizens and minority citizens carrying firearms and shooting firearms like everyone else does in this country, then it won't be such a fearful thing.
Well, I should say not everyone else, but a heck of a lot of people who have guns in this country. But, you know, Philip Smith, again, from the National African-American Gun Association, his point was that he's seeing fear among African-Americans because you have groups that were once on the fringe and that are racist almost being normalized. He's feeling from African-Americans a fear of that. Are you at all hearing that from people who want to be trained using guns?
I definitely do. A lot of the women that come to my classes, they feel as though they don't want to tell anyone that they're getting trained with firearms because it'll make them a target. And I feel like we can't have that fear. I'm traveling the country. I'm taking these photos. These images are getting out there again so that we can normalize it.
Are you saying you want the message to get out to, let's say, white supremacist groups that African-American women are armed?
Yes, I think everyone should know that we are armed. I think the attacker in the alley all the way up to the white supremacist group should know that, hey, we're armed. We're not defenseless as we once were 40 or 50 years ago when there were laws in place specifically to keep African-Americans from owning firearms. We have defenses now, so we're not going to be easy prey.
Well, what about the statistics from the Congressional Small Arms Survey, from the Centers for Disease Control? In 2012, there were 259 justifiable homicides in the U.S., killings in self-defense. So 259, but there were 232,000 guns stolen, 20,000 suicides with guns. Women are five times more likely to be killed by an abuser if he has access to a gun, including hers. Now, we hear that women in firearms training classes often ask, you know, can they just shoot to injure, not to kill? The thinking is that some of these women will, in fact, become victims of their own gun.
I think they're victims of their own guns because they're not educated. The problem in this country is that women buy firearms or usually have firearms purchased for them, and they never get any formal education. So they're carrying it around. It's kind of a placebo effect. It's not actually making them any safer. It's just they feel better having it there, although they don't know what they're doing with them.
Boy, the statistics are really amazing. The Pew Research Center in 2012 found less than a third of Black households viewed gun ownership as positive. But by 2015, 3 years later, that number had jumped to 59% of Black families saw owning guns as a necessity. Now, again, what do you say to people who say that more guns in circulation mean more gun deaths of innocents?
It's not the firearms that are causing these issues. Like people say, guns don't kill people, people kill people. And a lot of those deaths that get rolled into those statistics are accidental deaths. And the way to combat that is education. If you learn how to use it in the proper way it's meant to be used, then we won't have that fear.
What's the one thing you do differently if there's women that you're teaching?
I don't necessarily teach the information differently. I think it's the fact that there is a woman teaching the class that makes them more comfortable in the classroom that makes all the difference.
Are there women, and there may be men as well, who have said, you know what, I actually thought I was going to use this gun and train to protect my children. Now that I'm more familiar with this gun, I don't want it in my house.
Yes, and I honestly respect that opinion. The problem is a lot of people who are making the laws and who are making decisions about gun ownership in this country have never gone to a range. They've never taken a class. So until you've actually done it or experienced it, how can you formulate an opinion about it?
Are you a member of the National Rifle Association?
I am still currently a member of the National Rifle Association.
Yeah. Some people think of that as a very right-leaning political organization.
They are, and they're very open and loud about their political stances. In their eyes, it's like if you don't support the current presidential administration, then you're completely anti-gun. And that's not necessarily the truth. You can say, I love firearms. I love your advocacy for firearms rights and gun rights. However, I also disapprove of some of the things in this presidential administration. They're alienating an entire group of people who may want to be a part of the National Rifle Association and take advantage of the opportunities that they have.
Do you mean people of color, minorities?
Yes, minorities. And that's why Phil created the National African American Gun Association. So they feel like, well, if you've been alienated by other organizations, you can come here and feel welcome.
You've also mentioned another group. Is it Well-Armed Women? Do you feel welcome there?
I was a member at one point in the South chapter of Atlanta. Our chapter is actually all African-American women. So I felt really comfortable. And then I would tell other women across the country, hey, check out this organization. And they would go to their website and they wouldn't see any women of color. And they felt like, well, is this organization for me? Because I don't see myself represented, you know, on their website. So I don't know if I feel comfortable there. So I think they could get more members also by opening up their minority group.
Well, Marshall Tigner, firearm instructor, founder of Trigger Happy Firearm Instruction. And again, she's not asking you to be trigger happy with a gun, but in making decisions in your life. Marshall, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me on the show.
And another stat, African-American women outpace all others in securing concealed carry permits in Texas, though they have far fewer guns overall than whites. Your thoughts, welcome at hereandnow.org.
President Trump's proposed 2018 budget calls for a 90% cut in funding for agencies that support the arts. That includes money for museums, artists, and libraries, which are already under siege at the state and local level. New England is home to many of America's oldest public libraries, and the region has been hit especially hard. Reporter Tom Verdi has the story.
On a sultry weekday morning, patrons escape the heat and gather at the Essex Public Library in Essex, Connecticut, for a weekly book discussion.
So what did you all think of the book?
Great.
I loved it.
Couldn't put it down.
No.
Librarian Emily Boucher leads the discussion of Kazuo Ishiguro's 1989 novel, The Remains of the Day. Copies of the book litter the table, books on loan from other public libraries sent via the state's interlibrary loan system, a system which reader Bob Phoenix routinely relies on.
I constantly use it. The only other resource for me is to go and buy the book. And so that if I had absolutely no access, this would cost me a good deal of money each year.
But Connecticut Governor Daniel Malloy's office is also concerned about costs. Earlier this summer, it cut $1.7 million in funding to the Connecticut State Library. That's 18% of the library's operating expenses. That money helps support online research services, enables cardholders to physically borrow books from any public library in Connecticut, as well as interlibrary loan, a system which can actually save money in the long run. Glenn Gruby is the president of the Connecticut Library Association.
There's no reason that every library in the state needs to buy a copy of a non-bestseller book. It's much more cost-effective to buy several copies and move them around the state per demand.
Local legislative cuts to libraries also imperil federal funding. That money is contingent upon states contributing funds of their own. Connecticut receives about $2 million federal dollars a year, which the state library uses to support programs, services, and grants to local libraries. But under President Trump's proposed 2018 budget, that money may all but disappear in Connecticut and elsewhere.
Everyone, everywhere is having budget issues.
Jason Homer is a public librarian in Natick, Massachusetts, and a spokesman for the New England Library Association. He says that most public libraries are accustomed to belt tightening, but maintaining long-standing services like interlibrary loan is becoming increasingly difficult.
All libraries are committed to find different and more affordable ways to do that delivery, but delivery is being the hardest hit by the changing in our economy.
Funding for New England's 1,564 public libraries is as varied and distinctive as the region itself. While across most of the country, local libraries are run by counties, here it is often town by town, with funding coming from states, municipalities, and private sources. After the last major fiscal crisis in 2008, some libraries in rural areas such as northern Maine were hardest hit and had to close. Bryce Kundick is president of the Maine Library Association.
When a town is doing well, the library generally doesn't have a problem. What happens is when a town is not doing well. So when a mill closes down, when a factory goes away, then suddenly the town starts looking at its budget and looks at places where it can cut.
Arriving at a budget that includes funding for public libraries is a tough balancing act that University of Vermont Library Professor Selena Colburn has come to appreciate now that she is a freshman legislator representing her district in Burlington.
What I'm seeing as a legislator is just the disconnect in lawmakers' understandings of what a good deal libraries are for the state of Vermont, and I'd wager for other New England states as well.
That's because public libraries do more than lend books. These days, they also serve as information and educational centers for members of the community, says Richard Conroy, executive director of Connecticut's Essex Library.
We have roughly 400 programs per year that we put on that are attended by roughly 12,000 people, and that's basically double what we were doing 7 or 8 years ago, and a lot of that has to do with the economy and the services we provide to help people find jobs, help them with other social services. So it's not just about coming in, grabbing a book, and going out again.
Yet at a time when austerity budgets are being proposed in Connecticut and throughout the country, it's balanced books that remain at the top of many legislators' reading lists. For Here and Now, I'm Tom Verde.
And Tom's story comes to us from the New England News Collaborative. And today, remembering a man who left his mark on the arts and humanities, Sam Shepard has died. He was 73. Shepard won a Pulitzer for drama for his play Buried Child in 1979, and he wrote more than 40 other plays, as well as short stories and essays. He was an actor, too, nominated for an Oscar for his supporting role in The Right Stuff. Most recently, he appeared on the Netflix series Bloodline. We'll remember Sam Shepard's life and work this afternoon on All Things Considered. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.